KALW.
From KELW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale, down by Great America.
Sunset District.
In between Cupertino and Saratoga.
San Jose.
Oakland. Antioch.
Half Moon Bay.
Yeah, same here, Half Moon Bay.
Coming up, an experimental housing model that lets homeless alcoholics keep drinking. Could it work in San Francisco?
Even I, when I first read about it, thought, well, how in the world could you give alcoholics access to alcohol?
Then we'll hear a different take on one of the most dramatic tales in California history, the story of the Donner Party.
Louis Kesselberg was the last person out of the woods. And when he was rescued, he learned two things. His daughter had not survived the trip to safety, and people now called him Kesselberg the Cannibal.
That and more coming up on Cross Currents. Stay with us. In this year's homeless count and survey, more than 40% of homeless people in San Francisco reported drug and alcohol abuse. The idea of safe injection sites, where IV drug users can shoot up in safe, supervised environments, has been getting a lot of attention recently. But there's another experimental concept that's been struggling to break through for more than 5 years: housing explicitly for alcoholics, where they would be allowed to keep drinking. It's a controversial idea, but the data shows it seems to be working elsewhere. KALW's Andrew Stelzer reports some think it could make a dent in San Francisco's massive homelessness problem.
Traverse City, Michigan is a long way from San Francisco, but I wanted to see what an alcohol-friendly facility might look like, and this small town of 15,000 happens to be home to one, Dan's House. The first person I meet after walking in the door is Brian Dudley. He says finding this place saved his life.
Traverse City in the wintertime gets very, very cold. And some people die, some homeless people die. And I was almost one of them. Probably would have fallen in one of the lakes or rivers over here and just went bloop. That's about it.
Dudley is 61 years old and he's an alcoholic, by his own admission. But over the past year, he's reduced his drinking significantly.
Oh, I was drinking 2 12-packs a day. And a half a gallon of vodka. But now, you know what I drink? Not too much. A 12-pack will freaking last me up, till tomorrow.
A 12-pack every day or two might sound like a lot, but if you do the math, that's a huge difference. So how'd he cut down so much? By living in a house full of other alcoholics.
And then we received a grant from a foundation to renovate the basement and add another bedroom.
Dan's House is an unassuming one-story home along a busy road. It houses 8 chronically homeless alcoholic men. Walking through the kitchen, I see a pot of chili bubbling on the stove for lunch, but that's not where the action is.
And we have this great thing called a garage.
It's kind of the man cave.
Well, it's definitely the man cave.
I'm soon led out back, past a garden with Detroit Tigers logos stenciled along the fence, and into the heart of the community.
How's it going, everybody?
Good. How you doing?
Good. But we have to warn you, what goes on in the garage stays in the garage.
Oh, okay.
You telling a reporter this?
Yeah.
The man cave looks a lot like a suburban teenage hangout. Old couches and easy chairs, posters on the wall. There's a bunch of guys in here drinking beer, smoking cigarettes, and marijuana. Medicinal, of course. Glenn Butler sips on a tall can of Natty Daddy malt liquor. He says back on the streets, he would have to chug his booze before the cops took it away or he was forced to share with his friends. Not at Dan's House. The pressure to drink fast, which leads to falls and other health risks, is off.
It was a place that I could sit and, like they say, sit and have a beer and know that if I went and bought 5 or 6 and put them in my refrigerator, that I didn't have to drink all 5 or 6 of them. I could have 1 or 2. And they were good and they were safe because everybody here respects each other's stuff.
This garage illustrates the housing first philosophy. That's a growing trend amongst experts in the quest to end homelessness.
Housing first essentially does not require that people are abstinent from any substances to attain and maintain housing.
That's University of Washington Associate Professor Susan Collins. She studied a similar facility in Seattle called 1811 Eastlake, which houses 75 chronically homeless alcoholics and allows drinking. Since its founding in 2005, it's become a national model.
This was the first Housing First effort that was focused on people with alcohol use disorders. Within the first year of operation, the Housing First model saved taxpayers about $4 million.
That savings came from fewer emergency 911 calls and trips to hospitals, shelters, and jails. And Collins says the people who live at the Seattle facility actually end up, on average, drinking less over time than when they moved in.
What the research unequivocally shows is that when we invest money in the health and well-being of our fellow citizens, everybody wins, right? So taxpayers save money, people's health improves, their substance use decreases, the problems they're experiencing decrease. They're able to retain housing and kind of, you know, become more stable parts of our community.
It's often a tough sell to neighborhood residents. So there's only a smattering of facilities like this all over the world. They're often referred to as wet housing, a controversial name that many advocates don't like. Some provide alcohol to the residents in doses. One in Canada even teaches residents how to distill hard liquor so that they don't do it wrong and end up accidentally killing themselves. So why hasn't San Francisco, where over 3,000 homeless people self-report drug and alcohol issues, gotten on board? For starters, there's still a pretty serious stigma about enabling drug and alcohol use. Former District 8 Supervisor Bevan Dufty says he used to be a skeptic too.
Even I, when I first read about it, thought, well, how in the world could you give alcoholics access to alcohol?
But the more he learned, the more it made sense to try something different.
A facility that really would have 75 to 100 individuals would definitely have an impact. You would see a change on our streets having that many people safe and housed.
Dufty directed San Francisco's Housing Opportunity Partnerships and Engagement Initiative for almost 4 years and brought Mayor Ed Lee to visit the renowned program in Seattle, where Dufty says he didn't see people hanging out on the street at all.
You don't see the problems that even you see on some of our regular shelters where there are folks that are on the street and then there are people that are dealing to those people. It's just not like that at all.
According to San Francisco's Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, the city does have 74 designated beds for alcoholics along with specialized treatment. But they are scattered across 6 different sites around the city, and federal funding rules make it hard to qualify. Advocates like Bevan Dufty say there's a need for the community and specific support that a central location can provide. He first tried unsuccessfully to create a 50-unit alcohol-friendly facility in a San Francisco church back in 2012. The concept almost made it into city legislation in late 2016, but it just hasn't gained enough momentum, according to Sam Dodge, who recently left his post as deputy director of the city's Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing.
It's certainly not the most pressing issue that I hear from constituents and from the Board of Supervisors.
Dodge says the city's giving higher priority to establishing safe injection sites, supervised places for IV drug users to shoot up. Plus, San Francisco's subsidized housing sites already have relatively tolerant attitudes about addictive substances. Residents don't automatically lose their beds at most city-supported housing programs just because of alcohol use.
Chronic inebriates have been successful in this housing, so we haven't seen the absolute need for a sort of special carve-out program.
But the Drug Policy Alliance's Laura Thomas, who lobbies on both city and state legislation, says that's all the more reason to move ahead with easily accessible, centralized housing created specifically to support alcoholics.
San Franciscans as a whole still want to try new things and still have that spirit of innovation and a desire to do something about homelessness.
Thomas's group commissioned a survey in 2016, which found 64% of likely San Francisco voters support housing allowing indoor alcohol consumption. She says San Franciscans want positive, compassionate solutions, but instead, political leaders generally offer options that criminalize the homeless, like the sit-lie ban.
I think that there's a lot of support for the idea here. I think the bigger problem is actually finding a program, finding a building where this program can be situated, given the intense demand for supportive housing and for affordable housing.
Given the housing crunch, convincing neighbors to open an entire complex dedicated to alcoholics on their block could be a monumental task. So for now, the idea isn't getting much attention. Back in Traverse City, Michigan, Patrick McConnell says that's a shame.
Every town of any size should have this option.
McConnell was living on the streets for 7 years before he moved into Dan's house. Now he's taking some steps to turn his life around.
I just recently got out of a treatment center. I went to check myself into a treatment center in northern Michigan. And that was just something that I knew I had to do for myself. Now, would I have done that while I was living on the streets? Probably not.
Traverse City's mayor and police chief are now on the board of directors. The success of Dan's House and similar projects elsewhere will likely keep the idea on San Francisco's radar. I'm Andrew Stelzer for Cross Currents.
KLW collaborated on this story with the San Francisco Public Press. You can find a link to their fall edition, which is all about creative solutions to homelessness, at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Sometimes we like to showcase the work of others who tell meaningful stories about the Bay Area. One of those people is Nate DeMayo, the man behind a podcast called The Memory Palace. He made a story that took a different kind of look at the Donner Party. That's the tragic story of westward bound settlers in the 19th century who resorted to cannibalism to survive a harsh winter in the Sierra Nevadas. We'll share with you a new perspective on that old story in Nate's tale called After Party.
Louis Kessenberg wasn't a good man. He cursed and he stole. He would drink and get into moods, and then get into fights. He beat his wife. He was cruel. Louis Kessenberg wasn't a good man. But he didn't eat those people. In May of 1846, a wagon train carried 87 pioneers west from Independence, Missouri, bound for the Sierras and the Sacramento River Valley beyond. There were 9 families in the caravan, but I only need you to see 2. The Kessebergs, the father, Louis, a German immigrant, 30 years old, 6 feet and strong, holding the reins at the front of a covered wagon. His wife, 10 years younger, huddled in the back with their infant son and 3-year-old daughter. And the Donners, 12 members in all, led by the father, George, his wife, Tamsin, his brother, his brother's wife, and 8 children. The oldest was 13. The youngest, Eliza, was 2. See her, wrapped in a blanket and in her mother's arms, as the woman tries to keep the little girl dry and warm as a sudden storm sweeps across the prairie. See little Eliza learning how to run and to jump and to speak in sentences, all while traveling night after day, month after month, across the North American continent. 1 out of 8 children, 8 mouths to feed, but 8 extra bodies, at least the older ones, to help push and to clear the rocks that block their wagons and slow them all down. That is what did the Donner Party in. They were too slow. And that's why so many of them died in the winter of 1845, 1846. Though others died before they even got to the mountain pass that would someday bear the party's name. They lost 1 to tuberculosis, 3 to accidents. Louis Kessenberg kicked an old man who worked for him out of his wagon, forced him to walk, and the walking killed him. Louis Kessenberg wasn't a good man. Those deaths slowed them down. There were reasons they were too slow. Reasons they arrived at the mountain pass at the end of October, when the snow began to fall. Between the 1st of November 1846 and the 1st of May the following year, 36 members of the Donner Party died, some from the cold, some from injuries or illnesses for which there was no care, others from starvation. One, a 12-year-old boy, died right after being rescued from overeating. Others died in ways that have since been lost in the snow. But 46 people came out of the woods. 46 people survived to go on and go off and mourn their dead, and build homes and find work, and live out the rest of their lives. But I only need you to see two. Eliza Donner was 3 years old when she was rescued from the mountain. She was taken from her parents, who let her go because they were told there was another rescue party arriving soon. She and her two half-sisters, both in their early teens, were brought to a fort run by the United States Army, and they waited there for their parents, who were expected any day. But days turned to weeks, and winter turned to spring. And then, one evening, just before bedtime, Eliza heard a knock, and she looked up from where she was playing on the dirt floor of their adobe hut. Two bearded men with sad eyes removed their hats and whispered to Eliza's big sister in the doorway. And then her big sister started to cry. The people at the fort, especially the women, were kind, or they tried to be anyway. They told her how sad they felt for her, how much better it would have been for her to have died up there with her parents rather than live without them. They'd reprimand their children for wanting to play with her. She was 3. Later, as an adult, she remembered running off to be alone among the wildflowers, to get away, she wrote, from the torturing sympathy. But she would never be able to run far enough. She would never be able to step beyond the shadow cast by the events of that winter. Because although she must have remembered very little of what happened to her on the trail, flickering faces, a feeling of her mother's lips on her cheek, of her father's hand in her hair, she heard about it over and over as she grew up and as she grew old. You still hear it now, 160 years later. You don't hear the details, you don't remember the whole thing, because it was a long time ago, and they weren't your parents. You know, they got stuck in the snow. Some of them starved, and some of them survived because they ate the ones who did. It's the Donner Party. That's why you've heard of it at all. And maybe you've heard recently that historians and forensic scientists and whoever now think that no one ate anyone up there, that the country's most famous cannibals were not cannibals at all, that thrown on top of the horror of nearly starving in the woods, of surviving when those you love did not, people made up stories that made everything seem even more horrible. And those stories hovered around Eliza like a halo of mayflies. They preceded her into every room she entered for the rest of her life. She was the girl whose parents died. She was the girl whose parents were eaten. She was the girl whose parents were eaten by Louis Kesseberg. Louis Kesseberg was the last person out of the woods. His infant son had died there in January. His wife and their own 3-year-old girl were rescued in February. And when he was rescued, 12 weeks later, he learned 2 things. His daughter had not survived the trip to safety, and people now called him Kesseberg the Cannibal. This story had preceded him. It went like this. When Eliza Donner's parents let her go off with the men, there was another set of men following right behind. The Donners would only need to hang on for a few days, 2 weeks at the most. But then more snow fell, and the rescuers had to turn back. When men finally came again, it was spring, and all that they found in their camp were the Donners' bones, and sorry about this, their organs, cooking in a pot over a fire. A fire lit by Louis Kesseberg, who had done something much worse than merely resorting to cannibalism. He had jump-started the process by killing Mrs. Donner, and he had also stolen all their money, about $6,000. That was the story that came down the mountain. There was no proof. It didn't matter. He sued for defamation and won. It didn't matter. Louis Kesseberg was not a good man. He beat his wife. Everyone knew it. He drank, he got into fights. He made that old man walk in the desert and the walking killed him. He was just the kind of man who would kill poor little Eliza Donner's mother. He was Keseberg the cannibal, everywhere he went, for the rest of his life. When he would try to get a job. When he would try to sit quietly at the end of the bar and drink a beer. Kids threw rocks at him as he walked down the street. Men would throw drinks at him. They'd throw punches. And it is hard to be a good man when you are Keseberg the cannibal. He'd punch back. And he cheated in business. He took on aliases and tried to get loans, which is illegal, if understandable. He would try to disappear. To escape the shadow cast by the horrible things that he swore he never did. And cast by the real regrets. The real wrongs. That he had piled up over this life of his. When he hadn't been a good man. So he would move his family. And take on a new identity. And start a new business and find his feet. Until someone would find out that he was the man who had killed and eaten Eliza Donner's mother. And then it would all fall apart again. In March of 1879, Eliza Donner heard a knock. She got up from her couch and crossed the parlor of her elegant home in San Jose. There was yet another writer at the door. They came by now and then. They were working on books. They were interviewing survivors. They needed to follow up on something she'd said to someone else some other time. She didn't mind. She was one of them. Eliza Donner spent her adult life researching the history of the Donner Party and trying to understand what happened during that winter that she could barely remember. So when yet another man came to the door wanting to ask her about those days and to tell her what he learned in his research, there wasn't anything he could tell her that would surprise her. She had read all the same books. She had talked to all the same people. And none of them could tell her what she wanted to know. None of them could tell her what really happened to her parents. There was only one man who could. And he never talked to anyone. And he hadn't been seen in years. And he was probably dead. And so when this man in her living room said he could finally prove once and for all that Keseberg had killed her mother, Eliza nodded politely. She sipped her tea. But when he said he'd found Keseberg, and he was going to confront the monster who had murdered her mother, who had eaten her parents, she looked up, and she said she wanted to go with him. 2 months later, Eliza Donner knocked on Keseberg the cannibal's door. He invited her in. She hadn't seen him in 32 years, and he hadn't seen her since she was a toddler. Louis Keseberg told Eliza Donner that he was not a good man, but he was not the bad man people said he was. He had admired her parents. He told her he tried to help her mother, but could not. And when she knew she would die, she asked him to bury her money by a tree and then bring it to her children when the winter thawed. And he did. But there were many trees and there was a lot of snow. And he couldn't find it again. And when the rescuers found him near death, they didn't ask if there was anyone else alive. They didn't ask how they could help. They just asked where the money was. And when he couldn't tell them, they got mad. And they made up the story that created the character of Keseberg the cannibal. The one he had been ever since. He fell to his knees and begged her to believe him. And she asked him to stand where God could better see him. And he rose. And she held his hands. And he asked her to believe him. And she did. 30 years later, in 1911, Eliza Donner wrote a book about all she had learned about what happened to her family in the woods those years ago. And she wrote about that moment, there in an old man's living room, when two people who spent their lives as the victim and the villain in a story they did not write, held each other's hand and wrote their own ending.
That's Nate DeMayo from his podcast, The Memory Palace. Find links to more of his stories and subscribe to his work at thememorypalace.us. That wraps up Cross Currents for today. Our team includes Raquel Maria Dillon, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Christine Nguyen, Stephen Short, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sajiko, James Rollins, and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. We like to focus our local music picks on musicians you may not know performing in intimate locations. Well, today is different because we're featuring Mill Valley superstars Metallica. Metallica is one of the headliners for a show benefiting the Emergency Relief Fund established by the Tipping Point community. Funds will be directed to low-income communities impacted by last month's North Bay wildfires, including vineyard workers, immigrants, students, and displaced young people. The event, called Band Together Bay Area, takes place at AT&T Park on Thursday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Trust in who you are.